I've actually seen something on the internet, and I thought it was a really good short talk. So it's not going to be mostly this, it's going to be mostly this person, but you'll see on this TED talk in a moment. But I thought it was really good, and it inspired me. And it's actually about the story of David and Goliath. And I know we always enjoy the story of David and Goliath. It puts a slightly different perspective on it, and I hadn't thought about it this way before. And when I heard it, I thought, yes, you're right. You're absolutely right, and we missed that. And I'll show you what I mean. I'm just going to read a little bit first from chapter 17 of 1 Samuel. Shall we just bow our heads? Dear Lord and our Father, we thank you for the opportunity again to hear your word. We ask, Lord, that you will speak through me this morning and through the words that the video is going to bring, and help us to understand just how much you love us and how much we can trust in you for our future. In the name of Jesus, we ask it. Amen. So, I'm going to be reading from verse 32 of chapter 17. So this gives you the outline of the story for weeks. The Philistines and the Israelites have been camped against each other, and it's a bit of an impasse because there's a kind of a valley in between. Nobody wants to go down into the low ground to fight because that's a disadvantage. So they're just in stalemate on the top, and they end up with this great big guy coming out and saying, send single combat, send somebody to me, we'll sort it out. And everybody's afraid to do it. So that's kind of the background to the story. And so David says this: "Don't worry about a thing," David told Saul. That's King Saul. "I'll go fight this Philistine." "Don't be ridiculous," Saul replied. "There is no way you can go against this Philistine. You're only a boy, and he's been in the army since he was a boy." But David persisted. "I've been taking care of my father's sheep," he said. "When a lion or a bear comes to steal a lamb from the flock, I go after it with a club and I take the lamb from its mouth." Okay, it's a brave guy. "If the animal turns on me, I catch it by the jaw and club it to death." Right. "I've done this both to lions and bears, and I'll do it to this pagan Philistine too, for he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who saved me from the claws of the lion and the bear will save me from this Philistine." Saul finally consented. "All right then, go ahead," he said, "and may the Lord be with you." Then Saul gave David his own armor, a bronze helmet and a coat of mail. David put it on, strapped the sword over it, and took a step or two to see what it was like, for he had never worn such things before. "I can't go in these," he protested. "I'm not used to them," or "I've not proven them," so he took them off again. He picked up 5 smooth stones from a stream and put them in his shepherd's bag. Then, armed only with his shepherd's staff and sling, he started across to fight Goliath. Goliath walked out toward David with his shield bearer ahead of him. Sneering in contempt at this ruddy-faced boy, "Am I a dog?" he roared at David, "that you come at me with sticks?" And he cursed David by the names of his gods. "Come over here, and I'll give your flesh to the birds and wild animals," Goliath yelled. David shouted in reply, "You come to me with sword, spear, and javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. Today the Lord will conquer you, and I will kill you and cut off your head. And then I will give the dead bodies of your men to the birds and wild animals, and the whole world will know there is a God in Israel." And that's fighting talk, isn't it?
Yes.
He had some confidence, this lad, didn't he? But where did his confidence come from? Right? Yeah? Where did that confidence come from? And this, really, the subject, how do we see ourselves as Christians? That's really kind of the subtitle of this message. And the top title, as you can see, says, "It only seems this way," all right? So how do we see ourselves as Christians, and maybe other people see us? Do they see us weak? But do we see ourselves weak sometimes? Do we see ourselves as downtrodden? Underdogs? Yeah? The world seems to have a one-up over all of us. How you see yourself will have an impact on how you behave. It's interesting, just happened to mention that in a different context in Sabbath School. But how you see yourself will impact on how you behave. So we need to think differently. If we're thinking, oh, you know, I'm the downtrodden, I'm the underdog, and really, what are we saying? Are we losing faith? Are we saying that God isn't big enough to deal with all of these things? We believe that Jesus, who overcame the world, was slain from the foundation of the world. He knew it was going to happen. He's already done it. You know, I would suggest we should be thinking more like this. First of all, we should be faithful. That no matter whatever our thoughts, our feelings, that can mislead us so easily, we should remain faithful. We should be people of integrity. We should be honest. We should be strong. And we should be victorious. And this should be the way we think all the time. Even when it seems like there's no reason to think that way, when it seems like the world, you know, in other words, there's a Goliath. Whether it's a personal demon situation that you're in, or whether it's a problem at work, it doesn't matter what it is, whatever that Goliath appears to be. Jesus says we've already won the battle. When you think about putting these stories together, how does that work? Well, this film that I'm going to show you now shows you something very interesting that I'd never thought about before. It comes from a particular perspective. That's the final thing there. That comes from Paul's writings, doesn't it? We should be more than conquerors. And to be more than a conqueror, you've got to already know that you've conquered. Yes. Yeah? Because you can't move on unless you know you've already conquered. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Right. Okay. So the victory is already won through Jesus, and when you know this, you can face the world with a very different frame of mind. Would you agree?
Yes.
Yeah? We don't do it sometimes. We wallow in the dust and the mud and the dirt, and woe is me because I'm a Christian and the world treats me so badly. Actually, we've already won. Let's not worry about any of that, and let's just move on, knowing that we're more than conquerors. And so what I wanted to show you then was this story, and it's actually called an underdog story. And I found that this picture, because someone else had picked up on the internet what this guy had talked about and used it as one of their sales presentations, you know, said an underdog story. I thought, well, yeah, you know, people have picked up on this. So, yes, it may only seem that way. So let's find out the truth of this. Richard, all you've got to do is tap the screen. And I've used that as a hyperlink, so it'll play a video. I just need to make sure we've got the volume, that's all. Click the OK.
Yep. So I wanted to tell a story that really obsessed me when I was writing my book, and it's a story of something that happened 3,000 years ago when the kingdom of Israel was in its infancy. It takes place in an area called Shephelah. What is now Israel. And the reason the story obsessed me is that I thought I understood it, and then I went back over it and I realized that I didn't understand it at all. Ancient Palestine had along its eastern border, there's a mountain range, still the same is true of Israel today, and in the mountain range are all of the ancient cities of that region. So Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Hebron. And then there's a coastal plain along the Mediterranean, where Tel Aviv is now. And connecting the mountain range with the coastal plain is an area called the Shephelah, which is a series of valleys and ridges that run east to west. And you could follow the Shephelah, go through the Shephelah to get from the coastal plain to the mountains. And the Shephelah, if you've been to Israel, you'll know it's just about the most beautiful part of Israel. It's gorgeous, with forests of oak and wheat fields and vineyards and. But more importantly, though, in the history of that region, it's had a real strategic function, and that is, it is the means by which hostile armies on the coastal plain find their way, get up into the mountains, and threaten those living in the mountains. And 3,000 years ago, that's exactly what happens. The Philistines, who are the biggest of enemies of the kingdom of Israel, are living in the coastal plain. They're originally from Crete. They're a seafaring people. And they may start to make their way through one of the valleys of the Shephelah up into the mountains, because what they want to do is occupy the highland area right by Bethlehem and split the kingdom of Israel in two. And the kingdom of Israel, which is headed by King Saul, obviously catches wind of this, and Saul brings his army down from the mountains, and he confronts the Philistines in the Valley of Elah, one of the most beautiful of the valleys of the Shephelah. And the Israelites dig in along the northern ridge, and the Philistines dig in along the southern ridge, and the two armies just sit there for weeks and stare at each other because they're deadlocked. Neither can attack the other, because to attack the other side, you've got to come down the mountain into the valley and then up the other side, and you're completely exposed. So finally, to break the deadlock, the Philistines send their mightiest warrior down into the valley floor, and he calls out and he says to the Israelites, "Send your mightiest warrior down and we'll have this out, just the two of us." This was a tradition in ancient warfare called single combat. It was a way of settling disputes without incurring the bloodshed of a major battle. And the Philistine who sent down their mighty warrior is a giant. He's 6'9". He's outfitted head to toe in this glittering bronze armor. And he's got a sword, and he's got a javelin, he's got a spear. He is absolutely terrifying. And he's so terrifying that none of the Israelite soldiers want to fight him. It's a death wish, right? There's no way they think they can take him. And finally, the only person who will come forward is this young shepherd boy. And he goes up to Saul and he says, "I'll fight him." And Saul says, "You can't fight him. That's ridiculous. You're this kid. This is this mighty warrior." But the shepherd is adamant. He says, "No, no, no, you understand. I have been defending my flock against lions and wolves for years. I think I can do it." And Saul has no choice. That no one else has come forward. So he says, "All right." And then he turns to the kid. He says, "But you've got to wear this armor. You can't go as you are." So he tries to give the shepherd his armor, and the shepherd says, "No." He says, I can't wear this stuff. The biblical verse is, I cannot wear this, for I have not proved it." Meaning, "I've never worn armor before. You've got to be crazy." So he reaches down instead on the ground, picks up 5 stones and puts them in his shepherd's bag and starts to walk down the mountainside to meet the giant. And the giant sees this figure approaching him and calls out, "Come to me so I can feed your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field," right? It issues this kind of taunt towards this person coming to fight him. And the shepherd draws closer and closer, and the giant sees that he's carrying a staff. That's all he's carrying, right? Instead of a weapon, just this shepherd's staff. And he says, he's insulted. "Am I a dog that you would come to me with sticks?" Right? And the shepherd boy takes one of his stones out of his pocket, puts it in his sling, and whirls it around and lets it fly. And it hits the giant right between the eyes, right here, in his most vulnerable spot. And he falls down, either dead or unconscious, and the shepherd boy runs up and takes his sword and cuts up his head. And the Philistines see this and they turn and they just run. And of course, the name of the giant is Goliath, and the name of the shepherd boy is David. And the reason that story has obsessed me over the course of writing my book is that everything I thought I knew about that story turned out to be wrong. So David in that story is supposed to be the underdog, right? In fact, that term, David and Goliath, has entered our language as a metaphor for improbable victories by some weak party over someone far stronger. Now, why do we call David an underdog? Well, we call him an underdog because he's a kid, little kid, and Goliath is this big, strong giant. We also call him an underdog because Goliath is an experienced warrior, and David is just a shepherd. Right? But most importantly, we call him an underdog because all he has is this giant, is that Goliath is outfitted with all of this modern weaponry, right? This glittering coat of armor and a sword and a javelin and a spear, and all David has is this sling. Well, let's start there with the phrase, "all David has is this sling," because that's the first mistake that we make. In ancient warfare, there are three kinds of warriors. There's cavalry, men on horseback and in with chariots. There's heavy infantry, which are foot soldiers, armed foot soldiers with swords and shields and some kind of armor. And there's artillery. And artillery are archers, but more importantly, slingers. And a slinger is someone who has a leather pouch with two long cords attached to it. And they put a projectile, either a rock or a lead ball, inside the pouch. And they whirl around like this, and they let one of the cords go, and the effect is to send the projectile forward at towards its target. That's what David has. And it's important to understand that that sling is not a slingshot. It's not this, right? It's not a child's toy. It's, in fact, an incredibly devastating weapon. When David rolls it around like this, he's turning his this thing around probably at 6 or 7 revolutions per second. And that means that when the rock is released, it's going forward really fast, probably 35 meters per second. That's substantially faster than baseball thrown by even the finest of baseball pitchers. More than that, the stones in the Valley of Elah were not normal rocks. They were barium sulfate, which are rocks twice the density of normal stones. If you do the calculations on the ballistic, on the stopping power of the rock fired from David's sling, it's roughly equal to the stopping power of the 45-millimeter handgun. Right? This is an incredibly devastating weapon. Accuracy, we know from historical records that slingers had, experienced slingers could hit and maim more serious or even kill a target at distances of up to 200 yards. From medieval tapestries, we know that slingers were capable of hitting birds in flight. They're incredibly accurate. Right? When David lines up, and he's not 200 yards away from Goliath, he's quite close to Goliath. When he lines up and fires that thing at Goliath, he has every intention and every expectation of being able to hit Goliath in his most vulnerable spot between his eyes. If you go back over the history of ancient warfare, you will find time and time again that slingers were the decisive factor against infantry in one kind of battle, against heavy infantry in one kind of battle or another. So what's Goliath? He's heavy infantry. And his expectation when he challenges the Israelites to a duel is that he's going to be fighting another heavy infantry regiment. Right? When he says, come to me that I might feed your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field, the key phrase is come to me. Come up to me, because we're going to fight hand to hand like this. Saul has the same expectation. David says, I want to fight Goliath, and Saul tries to give him his armor, because Saul is thinking, oh, when you say fight Goliath, you mean fight him in hand to hand combat, infantry on infantry. But David has absolutely no expectation. No, he's not going to fight him that way. Why would he? He's a shepherd. He spent his entire career using a sling to defend his flock against lions and wolves. That's where his strength lies. So here he is, this shepherd, experienced in the use of a devastating weapon, up against this lumbering giant weighed down by 100 pounds of armor and these incredibly heavy weapons that are useful only in short-range combat. Goliath is a sitting duck. He doesn't have a chance, right? So why do we keep calling David an underdog, and why do we keep referring to his victory as improbable? It's the second piece of this that's important. It's not just that we misunderstand David and his choice of weaponry. It's also that we profoundly misunderstand Goliath. Goliath is not what he seems to be. There's all kinds of hints of this in the biblical text. Things that are, in retrospect, are quite puzzling and don't square with his image as this mighty warrior. So to begin with, the Bible says that Goliath is led onto the valley floor by an attendant. Now that is weird, right? Here's this mighty warrior going, challenging the Israelites to one-on-one combat. Why is he being led by the hand, by some, you know, young boy, presumably, to the point of combat? Secondly, the Bible story makes special note of how slowly Goliath moves. Another odd thing to say when you're describing the mightiest warrior known to man at that point, right? And then there's this whole weird thing about how long it takes Goliath to react to the sight of David. So David's coming down the mountain, and he's clearly not preparing for hand-to-hand combat, right? There's nothing about him that says, I'm about to fight you like this. He's not even carrying a sword. Why does Goliath not react to that? It's as if he's oblivious to what's going on that day. And then there's that strange comment he makes to David. Am I a dog that you should come to me with sticks? Right? Stick? David only has one stick. Well, it turns out that there's been a great deal of speculation within the medical community over the years about whether there's something fundamentally wrong with Goliath, an attempt to make sense of all of those apparent anomalies. The many articles written, the first one was in 1960 in the Indiana Medical Journal, and it started a chain of speculation that starts with an explanation for Goliath's height. So Goliath is head and shoulders above all of his peers in that era. And usually when someone is that far out of the norm, there's an explanation for it. So the most common form of giantism is a condition called acromegaly. And acromegaly is caused by a benign tumor on your pituitary gland that causes an overproduction of human growth hormone. And throughout history, many of the most famous giants have all had acromegaly. So the tallest person of all time is a guy named Robert Wadlow, who was still growing when he died at the age of 24, and he was 8'11". He had acromegaly. Do you remember the wrestler Andre the Giant, famous? He had acromegaly. There's even speculation that Abraham Lincoln had acromegaly. Anyone who's unusually tall, that's the first explanation we've come up with. And acromegaly has a very distinct set of side effects associated with it, principally having to do with vision. The pituitary tumor, as it grows, often starts to compress the visual nerves in your brain, with the result that people with acromegaly have either double vision or they are profoundly nearsighted. So when people started to speculate about what might have been wrong with Goliath, they said, wait a minute, he looks and sounds an awful lot like someone who has acromegaly. And that would also explain so much of what was strange about his behavior that day. Right? Why does he move so slowly and have to be escorted down into the valley floor by an attendant? Because he can't make his way on his own. Right? Why is he so strangely oblivious to David that he doesn't understand that David's not going to fight him until the very last moment? Because he can't see him. Right? When he says, come to me that I might feed your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field, the phrase come to me is a hint also of his vulnerability. Come to me because I can't see you. And then there's, am I a dog that you should come to me with sticks? He sees two sticks when David has only one. So the Israelites up on the mountain ridge looking down on him thought he was this extraordinarily powerful foe. What they didn't understand was that the very thing that was the source of his apparent strength was also the source of his greatest weakness. And there is, I think, in that a very important lesson for all of us. Giants are not as strong and powerful as they seem. And sometimes the shepherd boy has a sling in his pocket.
Really shows that what we see is not necessarily what is. Yeah, all of the Israelites were looking at what they thought was an impossible way forward, and it's very possible that the giant had a weakness. And the connection I made with that personally is that that is probably true about the whole world. That whatever we might think is arrayed against us, at whatever level, whether it's a personal thing or whatever, that the truth is, the world has a weakness. It doesn't have Christ. Mm. Yeah? That's the very least. It's actually the most. Yeah? Because everything else follows from that. So no one really should be able to put us down. They can try, they can do what they like. But at the end of the day,
we can be confident that we've already overcome. And whatever was going on here with David, David knew he had God on his side already. And David knew, I think, that the power of artillery was going to outweigh the heavy armour easily. Yeah. So I think he had justified confidence. And it tells me two things really with David. First of all, is yes, he believes in God and he has that faith. Secondly, he has been tested himself over and over again, that he knows he can do in the strength what he says he can do. And that means we have to practice. We have to practice our faith, don't we? And we have to use it and think, oh Lord, no, I've got to face this Goliath, but in actual fact, we're just going to step out in faith, knowing that the Lord is behind us and will give us the strength. Yeah. And whatever we need, maybe a sling, whatever it is. Okay. So I hope you found that useful this morning. I certainly did.